Hey guys, before we get started, you know what the business is. You better follow us on social media. You better do it. This is a threat. This is, I'm shaming you into it. Follow us. Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at LaunchpadPod and our website, launchpadpod.com. Did I say Twitter? I meant X. Whatever. You know. We're on YouTube too. You can see our funny faces. I'm silly. I don't know. Are we selling
Well,
it? Did we do the thing? Did we do the
if you
business?
watched us on, if you're watching on the on YouTube, you saw how serious we were when we said subscribe and like and all that stuff. It really does help us. And I hate to sound like every other dildo podcaster, but especially fucking, I just watched the new Ghostbuster movies and what was the other one I watched? Oh, Godzilla. They're making podcasters look terrible lately in movies.
We
Like,
must be insufferable pricks, man.
yeah, that's what it looks like. I'm like, but people, like, we don't have the biggest following in the whole world, but people write us that they like us and that we're funny. And I don't think we're annoying. And maybe it's just because we're not talking about something.
If Godzilla was real, if ghosts were real, we'd be really annoying. Because we'd be like, please take me to Middle Earth with you. Please
Oh,
take me to Hollow Earth. You didn't take me to Hollow Earth last time, and I missed out on the
yeah. I
Godzilla
see the
adventure.
triangles in your daughter's paintings. Can I go?
Can
I, you know, like, especially with our friends, like, all of my friends know that I podcast, and I'll say kind of like half of them are in on the show. Like, half of them, like, I have shitty movie tonight. I have a buddy, Map. He almost always will will comment on an episode that we've done. So he's listening. Our friend Rachel, she's really into the show. She watches it and she is one of our big helpers at Comic Cons and events and stuff when we go. She's always talking about stuff. And then I have other friends who never talk about it. That's fine. But like, I'm not going to push my friends to do, like, hey, you listen? And I don't open with that when I meet someone for the first time, unless it's at Comic Con, right? Then you're like representing the show. But if you're just like walking around, you meet some idiot, not like, hi, I have a podcast.
Let me ask you this. In the world that I work, people are like, what are you doing? Oh, I did some podcasting this weekend. Oh, you have a podcast? And suddenly I'm like, oh yeah, I do. Yeah, what's it about? I really like, intellectual podcasts and book podcasts. Like, what's it about? I'm like, me and my old roommate from college argue whether Jason Voorhees could beat a predator or not. And usually the consensus is yes, but if Jason Voorhees teamed up with the Punisher, it might not work out so well. They're like, ew, tuned out. And but I always wonder, like, if I've told somebody about the podcast and they went and listened to it, and then we're like, oh, this guy's a toad.
Now pretend that instead of working in the film and TV business, that you're a kindergarten teacher. And someone goes, "Oh, you have a podcast?" I always go, "Yeah, but it has bad words in
So no,
it."
I like that
Sometimes it's like
response.
a parent of a student will be like, "Oh, you have a podcast?" And I'm like, "Yeah, but it has bad words in it."
Yeah,
And
you
every once in a
probably.
while, someone's like, "That's okay, I want to hear it." I'll be like,
But I
"Let
mean,
me."
if they come in your room and they're like, "Oh man, is that an Optimus Prime helmet? Oh, cool. Is that a Star Stormtrooper helmet?" Then you're like, "Here's my
Right. Then you know the difference. You know the person and you
podcast."
know the people who are gonna like possibly be into it or not, you know?
Yeah. Before I get too far down this rabbit hole, let's get on with the show.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
All right, welcome to Launchpad Podcast. I'm Aaron.
I'm Matt.
Matt, today we're gonna kind of do like a singular focus on, whoa,
No.
Lego Ed 209, sidetracked already.
Yeah,
That's
I'm
freaking
not
crazy.
singular focused on anything yet. Um,
We were gonna talk about a director who's quickly emerging as one of my favorites.
yeah, I want to open it up a little bit wider than that too, but
Ooh.
yeah, this has been Amanda and I had a conversation the other night, and I love movies. Like, and I think you're the same, and I think that's why we vibe so hard with each other. But like going to the movies, watching a movie at home, I love that experience. I love that we as a species feel the need to entertain each other with fake or sometimes real, but dramatizations of fake of real events in the form of plays and movies and shows and stuff. And we gobble that up. I mean, look at how big the entertainment industry is. Let's just focus on America just to say parameters. But like, how cool that so much of our lives is spent seeking entertainment from that sort of venue. And I'm like the biggest proponent of that. I love going to the movies. It's a thing for me. It's not just going to the movies. It's not just a night out. I like that. That's probably one of my favorite things to do, even by myself, either by myself or with a group, you know, and it you watch like an award winning film. Fucking great. You watch Fast and the Furious and it's just brainless, mindless action. Fucking great. I love horror movies. I very rarely actually get scared. I very rarely actually feel the tension. I don't care. I still enjoy the movie for what it's doing. And I know if, like, I think it's just because I'm super brave and strong. You can't scare me. But like, I think it's just I'm immune to it because I've done it so many times. I don't get scared. But I know if it's good or not. And I know if it's working on those around me or the public at large. And I love that. You watch, you know, movies with Kent, whether we're watching 80s movies that I grew up with and I'm now sharing with him, or some stupid bullshit that he likes that's baby nonsense and I don't care. I'm just watching it for him. I love that experience. Like, yeah. I love it.
I mean, you really hit on, like, what an interesting thing humanity has created. Mm-hmm. Telling stories at large. This is all this is.
Sure.
It's a new medium for telling stories and how we tell stories and why we tell stories. And it's just film to me is this pinnacle of storytelling, or can be a pinnacle of storytelling. I think it's become a pinnacle of mass marketing conglomeration bullshit.
Yep.
But when it is good, when it is telling stories, when it is saying something, when it is connecting with you on a way that is working, as you said, it's powerful. It's amazing. It's fun. It's escapism. It's expands your mind. It shows you different parts of things you've never will never be able to do or have never seen before. It opens your mind to new people, experiences, ideas. Like, I just love that. And I don't know. It's in a weird space at the moment, but you're right. When it's good, it's fucking good.
Well, and I feel like you're right. It is. There's, you know, you got the Marvel movies, you got the Star Wars movies, you got every kids movie that there is. And then the big vehicles with, you know, Barbie was a great movie for what it was, but what's the fucking guy in that movie's name? I can't think of his name.
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, like he's fantastic and he's like, he is a joy to watch, but he's also just a power punch where they're just putting him in every goddamn thing they can because we're going to go see it because of him. So yes, it is a scheme and it is a marketing and they are trying to crank this shit out just to crank it out and make money. But I do feel like we are at a pretty decent time now where we're kind of getting back to some of these auteur movies where there's a director or a writer trying to make their movie despite all the other, right? So Barbie is a good example too. Greta Gerwig wanted to make that movie the way she wanted, and she fought for it and she championed for it. And it's this movie that is enjoyed in multiple ways. A24, is that the name of the company?
Mm-hmm.
They are really making some shit that is purposely not what everyone else is doing. It's purposely a little bit more in depth. It's a little bit more of a vision. And I think some of that might be vision for the sake of making money. But I think some of it truly is like, this is the movie I wanted to make. If you like it, great. If you didn't like it, thank you for stopping by. But this is my movie. And I fucking love that. I love that.
We're just in a weird time because it's hard to make a level of movie that isn't commercially viable. And right now, to be commercially viable, you need to make $1 billion. It has to be worldwide viable, not just America, not just a sector of America, worldwide. Like, you need to be making $1 billion.
Right.
And nobody's like, that's super hard to do. Marvel's having trouble doing that. And it's the biggest medium market monster on the planet. So when A24 comes around and says, I'm going to make a tiny little movie for $5 or $6 million. It's like, you know, that's why they get to experiment. Mm-hmm. So it's cool. And I like that. And I'm hoping that there's a course correct soon. I feel like we're on the verge of, you know, maybe they break up some of these monopolies so it's not just the same three companies making the same shit over and over again.
Right.
But we're on that cusp, and A24 has been knocking it out of the park. And one of their staple directors is Alex Garland. And I mean, he's known, he wrote 28 Days Later. I think that's the first time I ever saw anything of his.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Which, I think it was my first too.
Which pretty dang good. I like that movie. And then he's directed a handful of movies that have been really great. The first one that I saw was 2014's Ex Machina. And yep. This is one of my favorite films, period.
Ever.
Really? One of my favorite films. It just blew me away. And it's not because it's better than a lot of the other films that could be on my list. It's mm-hmm. because here is a Stanley Kubrick movie standing on its own two legs by somebody who isn't Stanley Kubrick. Here is a place where it just felt so crafted. It felt so smart. It was, the VFX were incredible. Mm. It as a film fired on all cylinders and hit me in a way that I hadn't looked at a movie since like watching Stanley Kubrick movies in college. It really is like an evolution of that for me. And I don't know. I love Ex Machina. Also what it's saying about artificial intelligence and what, you know, what Westworld did later, the TV show Westworld did later mm-hmm. about computers becoming sentient. I was like, you know, this movie was like, to become sentient, you have to learn how to lie, you know? Yeah. And Westworld was like, to become sentient, you have to learn how to suffer. Like, it was so interesting. You know, then he followed up with Annihilation, which was a cool movie. I didn't love it, but it was freaking badass.
It also was one of those movies that that's the movie they wanted to make. It doesn't matter if you understand it. It doesn't matter if you like it. They presented that movie the way they wanted to make that movie. And you got to say, like, I didn't understand all of it. Like you said, I didn't love it, but I liked it for what it was. I liked that it was its own movie. You know,
did you see the movie Color Out of Space?
No.
Ooh, bruh.
Color Out of Space?
Color Out of Space. It's a Nick Cage movie that came out by the director, Richard Stanley, who is most famous for his failure of a film, Island of Dr. Moreau, with Val Kilmer.
Val Kilmer, yep.
If you've never seen that movie or the documentary about making that movie, like The Rise and Fall of Richard Stanley, it is amazing. He was an interesting director. He did a handful of cool, like, again, apologies if it's not the country that I think you're from, but I think it's Australian. Mm-hmm. If he's like, I'm New Zealand, you piece of shit, I apologize. I'm so sorry. I think he's an Australian director, and he made a couple of movies. One of them was called Hardware, which is about a killer robot in an apartment. Pretty low budget, but decent movie for what it is. Yeah. That movie has the actor who played Porkins being a sick pervert, and it has some very uncomfortable scenes of him saying some really nasty shit. But cool killer robot movie. He gets the chance to direct Island of Dr. Moreau. He's like, hell yeah, I want Marlon Brando, I want Val Kilmer, and it turns into one of the greatest disasters of cinema history. Watch the documentary. Go see that movie. It's fucking terrible.
I saw that in theaters.
But Richard Stanley came back and recently made a movie called Color Out of Space, and it's Nick Cage, and it is based on a Lovecraft book of the same name. And it is a solid movie, like super solid. And it's about a alien presence that comes to Earth, lands on a meteorite. And instead of being a slimy creature or a monster, it is a spectrum of color, which is fucking cool. What a cool idea. And by witnessing it, by being enveloped in this color, your DNA starts to change. And it is, this is where we get some cool creature effects. This is where we get a mother and son melding together into one creature, which is horrifying. It kind of drives you fucking crazy. Annihilation is, like, in my mind, the sequel to Color Out of Space, where this color, this spectrum has spread to a larger space. And these, you know, it's kind of the Aliens to the Alien franchise, where they have to go in with guns blazing and fight crocodiles and bears that scream like people.
I love it. Going back to Ex Machina, the movie was really good. Everyone's performance was really good. I like when you have a movie that's interesting enough premise and everyone's doing a good job and you're making it competently. I like when there's something in it that separates it from every other movie. Now, if you think about Ex Machina, and we won't go too deep into this because this isn't our actual topic, but there's really, for 70% of the movie, there's only three characters, possibly four. I like when you have that sort of thing where the whole movie is just pretty much in one large location, a building. and there's only a handful of people. It makes it different than every other movie. And I think that's a harder thing to do in multiple ways. You got to keep my interest better. The actors have more on their plate, more screen time, more work they had to do. They have to be more arresting and engaging. And I think that movie did it. That, to me, was the movie that turned a spotlight on Oscar Isaac and was like, Matt, you need to fucking check this guy out, because he is all sorts of creepy in that movie. And I was like, I want to watch everything this guy's ever done. I want to learn more about him. That overshadowed to me almost the entire movie. I want him to do more stuff because he's doing too much commercial stuff. And I think they're tamping him down a little bit, his potential and stuff, but he's fantastic to watch that. But coming back out to Alex Garland, that movie was so good. He did a couple other movies, and he just has a movie in theaters right now called Civil War that is, I think, fantastic. I saw it. Rumi saw it. We have not talked about it yet. And then based on that, I looked into one of Garland's other movies that Rumi watched and I also watched. So I cannot wait to talk about at least the experiences I had with these two movies. And I can't wait to hear what you thought about them. So
you want to talk about your experiences with men?
Before we talk about our experience with men, though, let's do it in the order we watched it. Let's talk about Civil War first. OK,
all right.
So I'll tell you where I was watching this movie. I saw this about 2 weeks ago in theater with my friend Barry and some other friends. I was very excited to see it because of the trailers I'd seen. Mm-hmm. I was very excited to see it because I knew it was the director of Ex Machina.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know anything more about it other than what the trailers kind of showed. Just the clips and action scenes. Oh, cool. Cool. Kirsten Dunst looked kind of hard in it. I was like, OK, I like that she's not, you know, wet upside down Spider-Man kissing. I don't particularly care for her usually. So I was like, all right, if she's going to try to show me in this movie that she's got some acting chops, let's do it. I have so much going on right now that I have been very tense and very anxious in general.
Yeah.
In general, all day at work with Kent, with Amanda, shit, just nothing terrible, nothing bad, but like my muscles have been kind of bunched up for the last couple weeks. So I go into this movie, Civil War, about a contemporary civil war happening in America right now.
Yeah.
The movie is crafted as such that you don't really know why there is a civil war. There is a president who's leading the majority of the United States. Texas and California, along with some other things, are rebelling against them, and they are making a civil war. Kirsten Dunst is a photojournalist with some other journalists that is making a mad dash to DC to try to interview the president before he gets overthrown and assassinated, which it looks like is going to happen. Holy fuck. I walked into this movie anxious, and the whole movie just made me like, I was
so
like
tense.
A steel fucking beam, man. Every like, and I'm not usually like that. So to kick it back to the beginning of the episode where we talked about watching these movies and enjoying the feeling, this movie hit me right in my body. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I said that horror movies don't usually affect me. This movie was affecting me, I believe, in the way it was trying to.
Absolutely.
I was not having fun. It was for real. It was serious. I was taking this movie seriously.
Yeah.
For sure. I've watched documentaries that have affected me less, even though they were about serious, real issues. And even though I am not having fun watching this movie, I'm in love with it because it is accomplishing its goal so well. And some of that is me, and I'm walking into it anxious, but I don't know if I could ever watch that movie again because of how deep it affected me. And it, like, you know, the movie itself, I'm thinking like halfway through, I'm realizing, especially in the last act, I'm realizing we are, and this spoilers, I'm realizing we're not watching this movie. Like the main crew is trying to get there to assassinate the president. So there's a good chance this movie is going to end with an assassination, like an execution, not just an assassination, but an execution. And the movie is crafted as such so that we don't really know if there is a good guy or a bad guy. So are they executing a president that was bad? Or are they executing a president and they're the bad guys? To oversimplify it, you don't know. The movie purposely keeps it androgynous. And I was like, this is a lot. I am not having a good time, but fuck yeah, this, I am all in on this movie. This is why we make movies, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting because a lot of people at work saw it and there's been a whole roller coaster. You know, the writers that I'm talking with, the writers on the show that I'm working on, some of them really liked it. Some of them are like, it just had no substance for me. And I was like, huh. All points are valid when they bring it up. They're like, sure. Well, there were just no stakes. Why did they want to interview the president? There was no stakes for them to interview the president. And I was like, right. But like in Apocalypse Now, why are they trying to kill Colonel Kurtz? Because right. He's bad. We don't even know if the president's bad. Here's what I was very impressed with. I thought I did not want to go see this movie, but it was Tommy's turn to pick the movie. I picked Godzilla versus Kong last time. It was his turn to kind of drive the ship that time. And he's like, I want to see Civil War. And I was like, oh no, I'm going to get all upset because people who know me, you start getting talking into politics and I'm going to start talking about pack of Molotovs. Let's go. Let's get out there. Let's like fucking fuck shit up. And I thought this movie was going to incite that in me, that I need to be learning to be a sniper, not working my job. This is like, I thought it was going to get me all radicalized and riled up. This movie then suddenly is like, no, I'm going to skirt that issue entirely. Correct, I'm not going to talk about politics at all. This movie is apolitical. And in a movie that I thought I was going in to see a very hard stance on a political issue, for it to be like, as you said, androgynous, I was like, this isn't what I thought it was at all. It's following these journalists, these war journalists, and making it more about the importance of witness and the importance of reporting and the importance of journalism. And I was like, that's a very interesting stance to take. And I really like that it had that ability to skirt all sort of the political landmines it could have stepped on. Because like you said, we have no clue. The only thing we know about the president that they kill is he stayed three terms and he disbanded the FBI or the CIA.
Right.
So in my mind, that's so they couldn't check balances on him. He sounds like somebody who we may already be hearing from. His rhetoric also kind of mirrored presidents that we've heard from in the past that are unpopular. So it was interesting. And I agree. It was really tense. I really liked it. I really did go along for the ride. And I think it is this generation's Apocalypse Now, you know, in a way.
I think that's a good comparison.
Whereas I think Apocalypse Now, though, had something to say about the war and how senseless it was. And I think this didn't have a war to say anything about that, but it did really show how senseless. Why are you shooting at that? Because he's shooting at me. Like, right. Like what, mm-hmm. what are we doing? It was striking. And I really liked how they did some of the in the battles show like freeze frames of what the picture they took in that moment. And I thought that was mm-hmm. cool.
It was. And I got to say, I guess really, truly, I thought this was going to be a movie about a civil war. And there are some really cool battle and some really cool set pieces. But you're not like rah rah John Wick feeling during them because the movie is not about the Civil War or the battles. The movie is about Kirsten Dunst and her journalism crew and how they're interacting with these scenes, trying to stay alive, but also trying to capture a story. She does an amazing job, I think, as this literal battle hardened woman who's just there to take those pictures. And she's got an old member of her crew and a young member of her crew that she's trying to balance between their experiences and how each of those young and new members are affecting her and her partner. And any scene, you're seeing it through her lens, literally, you know, to the point where at the very end of the movie, they are with a armed forces unit storming the White House. And it is a bitching tactical battle scene that is shot well. It is tense as far as like, oh, they're getting in, they're shooting, they're going to get to their objective. But then you remember that their objective is to murder the president, let's not say murder, execute the president. And you are not fully sure why. So are you, and you're literally embedded in this unit with her and her team. So you're like, are we with the good guys right now?
You have no idea.
You don't know. And she ends up, because of the way the movie unfolds during that battle, she breaks down. And there are moments where she's literally crawled in a ball with her head against the wall crying. And I lost it because, to me, the whole movie is trying to show, like Aaron just said, the importance of witnessing, the importance of telling that story. But it also is showing how hard and horrible humans can be sometimes, but also, I guess, kind of looping in what we said at the beginning about how we are the only species that tells stories to entertain. There are these people who tell us the worst stories. They get the worst news, the worst footage, because we as a species value that. We think it is important to see the video of a war, to see the pictures of the people being affected by the war, and take out, I guess, just like the movie, right? Take out whether that is the quote unquote right thing to do or it's a terrible thing to do. We as a species, as a society, have decided we want and need that. So there are people whose jobs it is to photograph and write about and bring a war back home. You know, this is a civil war, so it's here. But there are people in other countries right now in wars that America is not even involved in, and they are bringing that story back because they feel it is an important story that people need to know about.
There's one line. There's one line in the movie that, to me, encapsulated everything. And it's something that Kirsten Dunst, her character Lee, says. And she says, every time I took a photo, I sent it back home. I thought it was a warning to not do this. I'm like, get fucked up here, man.
Yeah, man. No, I hear it.
Damn. But it's like, right now, we live in this time that's like, people are so close to being on this level for this to actually happen. And she said that, and that hit hard, because there's an earlier scene where she shows a guy getting shoved in a tire and lit on fire. And it was like, holy shit. And like the 1960s Civil War, not the Civil War, the Vietnam War, that was the first war that was ever on TV, brought home on TV. And people are like, oh, shit. And they revolted against that war. You know, there was a whole thing, protests in the street. And even now, though, like the reporting of war has become a business. And now there's four companies, basically, that control what that narrative of that war is. And we are in a really weird time right now. We went up to Boston last weekend and walked around Emerson. And in the big alleyway that leads to the big Emersonian building, there were protesters camped out there protesting, the war in Israel and Gaza and, you know, the horrible things that are happening there. And then like that Thursday morning, cops went in there and roughed up those kids and hauled them off. And again, I don't know the reasoning why that would happen, but it's like it just rang super true to what we saw in this movie of how senseless war is, how senseless violence is. And, you know, it's seeing all of this happening around the country right now. Like, people were saying that this movie was almost too topical. And I think it did a really good job of skirting that and being just as topical as it need to be without being incendiary. But it was really powerful, that just that part of it. And, you know, I agree that there's a lot of things that I don't know who these characters are. They're very thin characters. They're very weak characters. But at the same time, you're impressing yourself when you watch that. Like, am I brave enough to be a witness? Am I strong enough do I have what it takes if this happened here? To what would I be? What would my role be? Would I be a fighter? Would I pick up a camera? What is the future for us here? And that I think it asks some really fucked up questions that, I don't know, like I said, choked me up. Here I am crying on YouTube.
For sure. And it really, like, I agree with you. It's not incendiary, but for sure, it does not take a political expert to see that, like, we are not very close to what's happening in this movie. It's not like that could happen tomorrow. But it also is not far-fetched to think that that could happen based on how things are now. It's not, you know, and it's also, we've mentioned Vietnam, and we've mentioned Apocalypse Now. Mm-hmm. Apocalypse Now was made after that war. So when you're watching it, it's a reflection of that war and that time. If anything, Civil War is a state of what could be around the corner. Yeah. And it's not like 30 years from now. It's closer than that. So it feels like it hits home, and it feels, it's exactly the quote that you just said. That movie is kind of like a warning, because holy shit, like, there's a chance that that's coming.
Here's something, and again, this is way more political than we usually get on our podcast. I think one of the things that's just really important to remember is, like, anytime you dehumanize an opposing opinion or an opposing person, you dehumanize them to the point that you can kill them. Like, you're doing it wrong. You're in the wrong place. Like, that's just the wrong place to be. And when I see what's happening in the world right now, you have two groups of people who have dehumanized them each other to the point that they're like, we're just going to slaughter the shit out of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one side's obviously doing it way more than the other. And the ability to dehumanize another human being to the point that they are an enemy that can be wiped out, that they can be killed, that you can just level everything that they built in their life. Like, that to me is something that America is toying with, you know, that we have two political sides that seem so far apart that there isn't a reconciliation. And they're starting to get to that point where it's like dehumanizing the other opinion instead of saying, whoa, 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 I don't agree with you, but let's find a human place. I'm hearing people who are like, there's no coming to the middle here. If you agree at this, and if you are on this side, there's no coming to the middle. And it's like, if we can't even find a place to agree on something and we just start dehumanizing, they're monsters, you know, they're pedophiles. That's the one they like to use right now. You disagree with me. You support pedophiles. Like, you're starting to build the framework that leads to the ability to kill those people because their ideas don't match up with you. And that's fucked up. We can't get there. We can't let that happen. Like, where is the human middle?
And the dehuman, it's interesting because, again, bringing it back to the film, when you think about, we keep saying Vietnam because that was such a contentious war, such a contentious situation. When you think about that, when you look at movies and media, whether it was real, you know, like non-fictional material or fictional, when it shows the American forces as being less than human, or it shows the enemy forces being more than human, you start to be like, oh shit, this is not as black and white as you think, you know? And we think about war like that for many different reasons. When you look at this movie, both sides are just soldiers. You don't know anything else about it. And it's like literally the scene that there's a scene where there's snipers and they're just shooting at a building and there's a sniper in the building shooting back. And they, you know, Lee says, or I think it's actually the guy, but he says, who's
Joel.
In there?
Yeah.
Who's in there? And they're like, we don't know. And he's like, but why are you shooting at them? And he's like, he's shooting at us. And it's just so clear that, like, they, like, if you're in a war and you're in a trench or a bunker or a house or a whatever, and someone shoots at you, you're going to shoot back. And that's all you're worried about that moment. Yeah. You're not worried about what your president says. You're not worried about what their president says. You're not worried about what their objective for the day or the mission or whatever it is. You are trying to stop that person from shooting you by shooting them. And it's, I mean, I've never been in a war. I don't think about that often. But at the end of the day, what is that person's immediate goal? Is to stop the enemy and or not be killed by the enemy. That's all you got to do that day, you know?
Yeah.
And when you have a movie crafted like this, you don't even know, when you're the audience, you don't know what side you're on. There were times in the movie where I wasn't even sure which group they were with, let alone if that group was the good guys or the bad guys. But like, are you with the group that is rebelling, or are you in the group that is what's left of America? And it doesn't really tell you. Like, I think there's little ways you could figure it out, but it doesn't tell you. And it doesn't matter for the movie. If anything, it's supposed to, I believe, supposed to show you like what a fucking shit show it is, right?
Yeah. I hope, because the thing is it's doing well with all factions, or at least people are going to see it. It did pretty good. And you know, whether you're, you know, depending on whether you're a Democrat or Republican, this movie was able to speak to you. And I would really like to know what people saw in it. Like, what president did you see get assassinated there?
Mm.
And it's interesting because people are all like, why would Texas and California band together? That makes no sense. They're such political opposites. And in the movie, they never say this, but Alex Garland has said this outside of this. He said they are such independent states, and they saw something that they could agree on that was not American.
Right. I read something like that too.
And that's why they would come together. And you know, they put aside their political differences to stop a fascist ruler.
Which is like, and that was one of the first. And like you said, that's one of the only things that the movie says about the two sides is they say that one of the rebelling side is Texas and California. And you're like, Texas and California, why would they be together? But then the movie doesn't even give you time to think about that. And it's just like, we're in it and we're going. And I think it's just a really smart way to make a movie. And it's like, I have a very short list, probably four movies, maybe, that I love so much, I don't know when I could ever watch them again. This is like that level of like, man, I could write a paper on this movie, but I don't want to do the research on it. I don't want to watch it again just because. And I was like, I was already pretty anxious and tense walking into it. Maybe if I was a little bit more chill, it would be a bit different. It would land a little different. But I don't think so, because I think I'm a smart enough person that I know what the movie's about and I know how to read the movie. But yeah, that wound me up.
There is one scene in it that really tells you sort of who a bad guy is. Only one. And it's the Jesse Plemons scene. We come across Jesse Plemons, who is Kirsten Dunst's husband, maybe ex-husband now, but I think they're married. Maybe they're still married.
I think they're still married.
Anyway.
But I say that based on no real reason.
I just believe in love. so they're in it together. He's in it, and he's this soldier, and he's basically filling a mass grave, which by all accounts is a war crime. And he's filling a dump truck full of bodies into this mass grave.
And they're civilian bodies. They make a point to say, are they in military uniform? No.
No. He's going around just executing people. He's about to kill some of the reporters. And they come out and they say, hey, you know, we're reporters. And he's like, okay. And they're like, we're Americans. And he says, and this is the big trailer line. Yeah, but what kind of American? And he starts killing anybody who isn't like born in America. He kills the two. One's a Hong Kong reporter. And he's like, I'm American. He's like, yeah, well, where were you born? He's like, Hong Kong. Pop, shoots him. It's like, oh, shit. And I don't know if that has anything to do with the war or not. Is there anything, any sort of xenophobic tint to it? Or is this guy just some racist wacko?
Right. Is he speaking for his side, or is that just that specific soldier? Right.
Yeah. Because like, yeah. And it's a very tense scene. It's very, very well done. He steals that scene. But it is, again, just like Apocalypse Now, because my argument about it, you know, people who are like, well, it's not really about anything. I'm like, well, it's about how war is banal. There's nothing that makes any reason behind it matter. You shouldn't be having a war,
right.
Period. There's no reason that's going to make you go, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah. You know, there's just no, you know, and it's like Vietnam was the one where it seemed to make no sense. You know, when you look at World War II and you're like, fuck yeah, we should stop Hitler. That seemed like that was one of the last wars that really seemed like, yeah, there's a reason why we got to go do this. This guy's trying to take over the world literally and kill people in mass in his wake. And that seemed like one of those ones that was an easy black and white. We're the good guys. They're the bad guys. Let's go get them. But then Vietnam was just kind of like, why are we meddling in this little country's problem to stop communism? And I mean, not to say that what was happening from the communist side wasn't fucked up, but like it did get really muddy. And this is just shows how muddy it is. And does it really matter why? I think one thing I would have really liked is more from their characters of why. I understand Kirsten Dunst, but the character Joel, the guy she's with, he's like, I gotta interview the president. Why?
And then he was only really in the movie for that. Like he didn't really. And he was a more a less polarized character than the rest. So he was kind of like a neutral middle. But other than that, he didn't have much important shit to do, I thought.
And then he gets the chance to interview the president and he asks one question. Is like, yeah, all right, fine. Pop, 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 pow.
Yeah.
I love the ending, though, man. That end. I loved it. It was great.
It was, I mean, it was great, but it certainly had a reaction, you know, and for me, you know, and I was like, this is going to end probably like most likely this is going to end with an execution. And it ends with an execution before they even get to the president. You're like, oh, fuck.
They're not going to get prisoners. They're not trying to talk to this guy, you know? And then I was like, I don't know if he's the bad guy or not. And even if he is the bad guy, I don't want to watch an execution. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't want to see someone walk into, I don't want to watch a movie where someone walks in a room and just blows Hitler's brains out with no context. Even if I know it's Hitler, you're just watching someone die. I mean, on a film that's fictionalized, it doesn't, you know, you
not
could,
just somebody, Nick Offerman, one of America's
which,
favorite.
When you think of that too, if Jesse Plemons was the president, you would be more okay with that assassination, because you usually think of him as being a creeper, as being a weird guy, as being a bad guy. But Nick Offerman, at the very least, is okay, right? Yeah. He's usually a little cuddly sweetheart that everybody likes.
Yeah, a little bit of a curmudgeon character, but he plays it well. And like from his role in Parks and Rec, he's a diehard libertarian. So like, it's like, am I impressing some of that upon him for this movie?
Sure.
Is he some sort of libertarian president? Like, you don't know, but it is wild because, you know, he dies pleading, which is fucking oof.
This, and that's the thing. And if Adolf Hitler died pleading, if I, you know, we're going to extremes, right? How much more extreme can you get than Adolf Hitler? But a defenseless person pleading for their life as they get killed has got to hit you somewhere. I don't care if they're evil. It's still a life, right? And it's one thing if a evil person is fighting and dies, but to literally be on the floor with their hands up and pleading for their life defenseless, that's heavy shit.
This is a heavy podcast, man.
Well, do you want to change it to the next one?
Oh, yeah. Let's switch it over to Toxic Masculinity, the movie. Great. This is going to lighten up the environment, you know? Yeah, I think we can. It's a good movie. Here's my last complaint about the movie. Again, I really liked it, but I just have issues with, I think it could have been more, but I think it threaded a needle perfectly where it needed to. Mm. I wanted more from the characters, but I don't think the movie had, like, I don't think that would have made me come away with any different opinions of how the movie felt, other than like, if you added that character craft in there, I would have been like, man, perfect movie. But right now I'm like, yeah, fucking great movie. Which again, you're still at a A minus versus an A plus or even a B plus. You're still passing, man. I'm super impressed. It was very well done. The only place where I'm like, big, huge, massive missed opportunities, when those credits roll, Guns N' Roses didn't play. Like, you couldn't get that song. I don't need no civil wow. Like, come on. That was a huge missed opportunity. If you couldn't have made that, like, if that had rung out after like the credits rolled, I would have been fine.
The music was actually the one thing that I kind of like didn't like. I know what they were going for. I see what they were doing. And I like the idea. And again, like any movie that takes a stance and does what it wants to do, I appreciate it. But I didn't like the music choices. They did a lot of diametrically opposed music where the music was juxtaposed for what was happening on the screen. Yep. But it like did it so much that it became in the forefront as opposed to something in the back to make me think. But that's just my personal opinion. And certainly, like, I don't
Matt
give it any
Matt
negative
hates needle drops. We've established this.
I do. Well, it's got to be worth it. The only reason I like it in this case is that is such a big thing, again, for Vietnam movies. And Vietnam movies, we usually, I think, overall equate with anti-war movies. Most Vietnam movies are anti-war, so this feels like a more contemporary version of that message.
It's funny though, because in Vietnam movies, the soundtrack is super important. You know, you get mm-hmm. you know, Creedence Clearwater Revival in there, Run Through the Jungle, you know, and the songs from that era were anti-war or about the war,
right?
And you're like, and it fits. It really just fits that time period. I can't think of a Vietnam War movie not having that soundtrack. But like watching this movie, I did have a moment like, is that really our Vietnam soundtrack? Right. Is this our war soundtrack? Like, it was like in the 90s, it would be just a lot of Rage Against the Machine. But like the soundtrack for this didn't seem to fit the war. But I get it. So I do get that.
Yeah, I get that. I get that.
So then Matt was like, have you seen his other movie Men, which came out in 2022? And I hadn't, and so last night I watched that, And because of that, I got to type in my notes the word assgina. So let's strap in. Let's get going.
I didn't have this thought in my head until we were already talking today, Rooms. But I guess you could say there's two kinds of movies. Ones that you are a passenger and you're not doing anything. The movie's driving. You're just along for the ride. Godzilla Kong, great example of that.
Yeah.
My brain is fucking off when I watch that movie. I'm not leaning in other than just to be on the roller coaster, right? I buckle my seatbelt in. That's the last thing I have to do for the next 2 hours. Movies like Civil War, and now we're jumping to Alex Garland's 2022 Men, I take a more active role, even if it's just that I want to know more. So I watched Civil War, and I was like, man, I really do like his stuff. What's something of his that I haven't seen yet? Men. Okay. Read the synopsis, and I was like, all right, interesting enough. Let's put it on. I immediately was hooked. The movie is, it's got a woman in it who I've seen in something else recently where she's dating Jesse Plemons, and I loved her. I don't know that I've known her from anywhere else. Her name is Jessie Buckley. She plays a character called Harper, and you see her, and she's upset. She's got a little bit of a bloody nose. She walks over to a window, and as she closes the window, a man falls through her field of vision. The window faces a balcony, and he is falling and looks scared. And you're like, what is this? Now, because of the summary I read, I knew a little bit about. Yeah, I had guesses as to what that was. We find out that that was her boyfriend slash fiance, whatever. He's dead. And as the movie in the present goes on, you keep cutting back to that flashback and essentially seeing the minute or two before the last flashback you saw. So you kind of see his demise. And then a minute before, like a little bit later in the movie, you see the minute before that. So you see how he stormed out of the apartment. And then later on in the movie, a minute before that, you see why he stormed out of the apartment. This character, Harper, Jessie Buckley, she goes to this giant mansion and she's just kind of going to chill out and gather herself. And every fucking thing in this movie just had me leaning forward, being like, what? What? Why? What is this? Ugh. Excellent performances. There's only a handful of people in the movie.
There's only like four people in the movie. Yeah. Her, the guy who plays her husband, the Rory Kinnear, who plays every man in the movie.
Literally.
Harper's friend, Riley, who most of the time only appears on the phone. And then there's like a police officer woman who talks to her. And the movie is thick with allegory. Lot of allegory. That's kind of its jam. And, you know, it's an allegory for shitty men, right? Is that the allegory?
So I thought the allegory was for shitty men, but the deeper I dug and the more I looked into it, I saw a couple other takes and I really did like the thing that I saw.
You saw the dandelion take?
That was part of it. So in this movie, guys, it's one of those movies, and A24 specifically as a company does this very well. But I do feel like we're getting these movies, these horror movies, these thriller movies like Hereditary and Midsommar and all these new age ones that really crank up that tension and don't traditionally just throw jump scares and MacGuffins and direct misdirections at you to scare you. They're crafting a scare. And sometimes it lands and sometimes it doesn't. But I like the overall tone. Like, I loved Hereditary until the end. I didn't really care for the end. It wasn't satisfactory for me. But as a movie, it was fucking awesome. That's the horror I want.
I love the end of Hereditary. I couldn't breathe. And this gets to that point.
Agreed. And I think this ending is a little bit more satisfactory for me. But
sure.
She goes for a walk. You know, after she kind of settles into this house and they've kind of set some stuff up, she goes for a walk. And when she goes for a walk, she sees this weird person that starts following her from far away. So she runs, gets lost. And when she gets to a giant field, she turns around and there's a pretty jaundiced, yellowish looking naked man just kind of nonchalantly following her.
Yeah.
And she runs home. They can't find him. Next scene. He is at her mansion, this mansion that she's staying at. And he's just kind of walking around outside, looking in. He almost looks like a zombie, not really threatening, but it's scary. And she's scared. The police come and arrest him. everyone's downplaying it. She goes to the local pub, everybody in the pub, and they all look very similar to the point where I'm looking at that guy and I'm like, is that the same actor?
It
he
is.
Looks just like that
He's
guy.
Every guy in every scene. He is every man in the movie.
Even a little boy. And yes. That was the first time that I was like, wait, are we supposed to think that they all look alike? We are. But it's
she
just
doesn't notice it, which bugs me.
Oh, but I think like, I didn't look and I was like, do they look like one guy has crazy English teeth? One guy has a facial hair. One guy is a little boy, but it looks like a kind of a CG version of this guy's head on him.
Yep.
But it was enough that I was like, am I crazy or are they all the same? But everybody's like, well, he's harmless. Don't worry about him. And they're like, he followed me 2 days in a row. And they were like, yeah, but he's not really doing anything. And then they let loose. Well, we had to let him go. What were we going to charge him with? And she's like, you let him go? They're like, yeah, don't worry about it. And they keep telling him, don't worry about it. You find out that the guy at the beginning was her significant other. She told, I think it was her husband.
It's her husband.
She wanted a divorce.
And he comes back with her.
Flips out.
Yeah, he flips out and he says, I'm going to kill myself. And she's like, no, you don't get to threaten me with that. He's like, it's not a threat. It's promise. I'm going to do it. And it's like, what a gross reaction. You know, threatening suicide is a gross power play. And she is like, okay, you need to leave. And he hits her. And then she pushes him out of the house. And we see that is the connecting point. She kicks him out of the house. And as she goes to close the window, she sees him falling and then goes downstairs and sees his body all fucked up with his leg broken, his head smashed, his arm is falling through the fence of a spike split down the middle. It's really gruesome.
Yeah.
And, you know, then this movie becomes, you realize it's a whole allegory for her grief, but also the way men treat her.
She meets a vicar, a priest kind of guy.
Yeah.
Who sits down and he's like, listen, I can see you went to my church. You're crying and screaming. I know you're hurting. What's going on? So she explains the situation to him and he listens and he's being supportive. And then he puts his hand on her leg and you're like, oh, weird. But she doesn't really react to that. But then he says, well, did you give him a chance to apologize? And she was like, what? And he goes, well, it's not a good thing, but sometimes men hit women and sometimes they kind of push him to. Did you let him apologize for that? She was like, no. And then he's like, well, then maybe you not letting him apologize drove him to that. She's like, fuck you. And then she gets up and leaves. And it's like, that's when, like, now it's not, do they look alike? Now it's not just like, does everyone saying weird shit to her? Now it's like, all right, for sure, something weird is going on in this place, right?
Yeah. And everywhere she goes, it's kind of like the movie Carnival of Souls, like an updated version of that.
Yeah, that's a great comparison.
Everywhere she goes, this guy appears in a different form, whether it's the priest, the cop, it's the same man, the same face on a different character. And it's funny because later in the movie, she's terrified. She's being chased by one of these entities. And then the priest shows up and I wrote, nobody ever in the history of ever has been like, oh, good, the priest is here. Yeah. Never has a priest shown up in a movie, especially a horror movie. And people have been like, yay.
Oh, good, I'm safe.
Yeah, good. Yeah, no, it's never a good sign when a priest shows up in a movie ever, unless it's the show Fleabag. And you're like, oh, he's a hot priest. You know, like there's just, I don't know. But this movie, I haven't had a movie in a long time that had such big highs for me. The balloon bop, as we say, when I watch a movie, it's like a balloon floating in the air. And every time a movie does something cool, it pops it up a little bit higher. And then as if the movie's not doing a good job, it sinks to the floor. And this movie had some really big bops of that balloon, kept it really high, and then would drag it back down. And then, whoa, super cool.
Let me hear, because I head over heels love this movie. I love it to the point where, like, I wanted to watch it again the same week. And Rumi said last night, he's like, I just finished it. First of all, he wrote, the fuck did I just watch is what he wrote. Back Gina, he wrote. And he said, I have never both liked and hated a movie at the same time and had such highs and lows. That's all I know. So I'm actually really interested to hear what your highs and what your lows were.
So it starts out pretty interesting. You're right. I'm in. Okay. Ooh, this guy fell out a window. He's dead. She's trying to recover from this grief. She goes on a walk. Still going on that walk. This movie's brought to you by Apple Wallpapers, going on a walk style. Like there's just all these shots of like pond, lake, forest, moss. Ooh, dandelions. And I'm like, Let's go on with the fucking movie. You had me at this moment where this guy fell out a window. Well, can we go back to that? Can you at least? So then they would tease you with a little bit more of this, like this story of what happened. I'm like, okay, now I'm in. Here we go. Now they're going to explain what's happening to me. Nope, still walking. She gets to this tunnel. It's really creepy. Cool shot. Really cool shot. It was cool the first time I saw that shot. And then we linger in more shots. And then she's like, oh, echo, echo, echo. And we do that for 2 minutes. And I was like, okay. And then you see this figure in the distance sit up. And then I was like, whoa. And then he starts chasing her. That was cool. Oh, okay. We're back on track. Let's go. Took way too long. This movie took way too long to get anywhere. And then when it did get there, it would defuse it with, I don't know, it just constantly diffused the escalation. And I think it worked against itself in that sense. But then it would do something really cool. And you're like, okay, all right. But like, yeah, that echo scene killed me. Oh, you want to hear my impression of the soundtrack of this movie?
Yes, I do.
Like, it was just atonal the whole time. Stupid as, oh my God. Like, and then they cut to this like pagan image of a leaf face. And then it would like spin around to like diddle face. And it's like this statue of a creepy pagan leaf face man. And then the other side is like this pagan woman, stone statue, diddling herself. And you're like, all right, here we go. I get it. And it would do something really cool where it'd have like one of the coolest VFX shots that I've seen in a long time. It did it several times and then have a shot worse than the background behind me on my Zoom. There's a shot where she's staring up at the stars and the composite is so piss poor. I couldn't believe somebody aired that. I can't believe that's like a version one temp comp in the Avid. And they're like, slap it on the big screen. Looks great. I'm like, your resolution in your stars isn't even correct. I can see the JPEG in there. Like, oh my God. But a scene earlier, there's a scene where this guy's reaching through the mail slot of the door and she takes a knife and stabs it through his hand. And then he pulls it out, splitting his arm in half. And for the rest of the movie, when the entities of this man shows up, he's got this quadro arm thing going on and it is cool. Mm-hmm. And then there's a scene where she's up in the bedroom hiding. And this is where the priest shows up again. I'm like, oh, boo, this isn't going to go well. And he's talking to her and she's like, what are you? And he mumbles a bunch of Shakespeare bullshit and doesn't tell her.
Swan.
Yeah. Okay, sure. Some sort of weird forest entity. There's a lot of dandelion imagery. And I read it's because dandelions are asexual reproducers. And that's this creature in this movie is a symbolism for that. And there's a shot in this where the priest comes. He's got his weird split arm and the camera pans up her back. Pan isn't the right word. The camera pedestals up her back and you see his split arm reach, two fingers on one side, two fingers on the other, and then rotates with her and pushes her up against a mirror. That's an impossible shot. And it is done brilliantly. What a cool fucking shot. From a VFX standpoint, I was like, I got to rewind that. Oh, got to rewind it again. How
you
the
think
fuck
it was
did
digital
just
as opposed to fake hand, like a prosthetic?
Yes. Yes. Because they move the fingers move. So one hand is real on her. One set of fingers is real. Then they must have had some either. I doubt it's an animatronic, but something that was finger like attached to his arm so he could do that. And then digitally they made them move. And then as he turns her around, I can see where the tracking is trying to keep it attached to his cloak, but they did a great job. And then again, so you do that with the rotation and everything, big 3D hand thing, but then you have this impossible shot looking directly into a mirror where there should be a camera crew. So now you've painted that out. And it's like, that's impressive. That's a really cool shot. It's one of the cooler shots I've seen in a long time where you're like, whoa, how'd you do that? Great. I always love it when you're watching something, it makes me stop and go, whoa, I can't wrap my head around what I just saw. And this movie, that was really cool when they did that. Same thing with the knife shot. I was like, how would I do that? How would I pull that off? Really, really cool.
For me, the stuff that you're saying about the echo down the hall, down the tunnel shot is too long. Totally get it. I understand what you're saying about too much moss and too much trees. I get it. To me, that was part of the buildup. That was part of the teasing. They're like, look, it's beautiful here. Look, she's having fun doing echoes and it's helping her. This is the first time she is, we've seen her feel lighthearted since this movie began, since she has this terrible tragedy that, right or wrong, she feels responsible for, and she is letting go. We see her looking around in wonder. She gets stuck in a little bit of a rainstorm and she's excited about it. And I again got hit in the emotions of, like, she is letting some of her baggage go. And then she's ha hoo, ha ha hoo, ha down the tunnel. All she's thinking about at that moment is ha hoo, ha. She's not thinking about anything else.
Once. And don't do it 10 times. Do it once. Do it twice.
I can't. I have no argument for that. I'm not saying you're wrong. But for me, I was like, this is not going to end well. This is coming. This is coming. But it's almost like a more sophisticated version of a jump scare. Or I won't say jump scare. I'll just say scare. Because I knew something was going to happen. And then at the very, it's a long shot down this tunnel, you see something move at the end. And then you see her reaction to it. And then you see the person at the end of the tunnel start running towards camera. And they're far away. And you're like, oh, fuck, that's not good. And for me, that was worth the tease. That was worth the drawn out. And that is the kind of scare that I like. So I'm happy with the time in between. I loved how they teased out the beginning of that story, you know, of her story, what happened at the beginning with this potential ex-husband, potential suicide guy.
There's one of my favorite moments in a haunted house. I love haunted houses. I love the craft of haunted houses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Universal Horror Nights, Halloween Horror Nights, really fun to go to, but very few of those haunted houses are crafted, you sure. know. They're kind of like, I'm going to put a guy here. He's going to jump out and yell boo. Yeah, that works. That's scary. But when you craft a scare, when you set it up, and this movie does craft scares, and that long tunnel shots, one of the most effective haunted house moments I've ever seen in my life was a long hallway, nothing on the walls. And at the end of the hallway, there was a bright light and a man stepped out when we stood at the other end of the hallway. Very long. He stepped there. He peeked out in a clown mask. And then ducked away around the corner. And now I have to walk all the way down that hallway waiting to see if that guy's on the other side of that corner. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the most scariest haunted house moments I've ever had. Is all of us, like, packed together, a group of friends, like, you go, you go, you go. And then you get there and he's not there. And I was like, that is brilliant. And if you can capture in the movie and that moment where he sits up at the long end of the hall of the tunnel, that I was like, smart. It's not a jump scare. There's no, like, it's just, and you're like, wait, did I see that? At the end, it was super cool. Like, it's when they got into it, they always did a good job with it. I just feel like it deflated the tension when it would cut away and then cut back to something that isn't as scary, or like she's being chased through this house by this entity. And then the priest comes in, he's like, I'm going to talk Shakespeare at you. And I was like, that deflates it resets the tension. Well, now you gotta work your way back up. And they do a good job of building it back up again and making it scary again. But it just kept sort of fighting against itself for what I was expecting it to do, which in some cases is great. Mm-hmm. And some cases, again, like I was like, it was a roller coaster. And I like where it ended. Because it got fucking weird.
Well, I think it's interesting. And the way that I see what you're saying is, instead of working against itself, there were two things she was dealing with. She is the main character, right? She's dealing with the menace that is happening to her, this weird naked guy and people saying weird things. But then also, like, the police come and the police are like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And there's a woman cop there, too, who seems a little bit more sympathetic. Then you have a lot of male characters who are not sympathetic to her, and the priest guy flat out says, maybe you drove him to suicide because you didn't let him apologize. Then later she goes to this pub and there's a couple guys there, including a male police officer who took the naked guy into custody. And he's like, yeah, he was naked. He was weird. He didn't say anything. And we just let him go tonight. And she's like, you let him go? And he's like, yeah, why? And she's like, you let him go? And no one in the pub can kind of understand why she might be upset about that. Like, it's not like they don't believe her but like they don't get it. And then there's one male character who's like, yeah, I could see why you'd be upset about that. And you're like, as a audience member, I'm like, oh, okay, but that's weird. So it's not everybody. They're not all weird guys. Then that same guy, it's her landlord that she's renting this mansion from. Later, after that scene, she goes back to the house and she is like out and out attacked. Someone comes running towards her front door. She slams it closed. They're banging, 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 trying to get in. The landlord ends up coming and she's like, there was just a crash in the other room. He's like, all right, let me go. I'm going to check this out for you. And he checks all it out for her. And you're like, okay, he's being sympathetic and buying into her. He's not being a chauvinist or, putting her in a corner or anything. He's listening. He's like, I understand. You're clearly upset. If you're this upset about something, I will look at it. And he's not, gaslighting her as much as everybody else is. So you're like, oh, okay, he's a good guy. Turns out he's a weird thing too and disappears. Then, like Aaron says, someone sticks their hand through the door. She knifes it, and the knife is trapping the hand. So the hand slowly pulls back out the mail slot, and the knife is slitting the hand right between two fingers. The knife clatters to the floor. Now that guy's out there. Now every other male we see for the rest of the movie has that floppy hand cut or, you know, arm cut in half, which is just awesome.
It's really
and
well
all
done.
These different versions of the same man or different men in the movie who are played by the same guy keep coming to her and talking to her and menacing her and explaining to her. And then the priest essentially tries to rape her. She gets out of it. And I also read that he mentions he's a swan because it has something to do with Zeus, who in a lot of those old mythology stories would come to Earth as a animal to then somehow try to get with a Earth woman. Yeah. So that's supposed to be an allegory for that.
It's got a lot of pagan allegories. It's got a lot of toxic masculinity allegories. It's got
But for me, I love this whole scene, this whole sequence, because the whole time, let's say the first two acts, you're building these weird tensions of why is that guy naked? Why is he following her? Why isn't the town taking this more seriously? Why? Now we're in the scarier part where it's the threat is literally banging on the door, literally chasing her around the house.
Yeah, it turns into like a classic juggernaut movie, you know, like a Jason Voorhees, except Jason Voorhees doesn't show off his ass gina and birth another
Jason
Voorhees.
Do you want to explain that part?
Yeah. So the pagan creature with the leaf face keeps evolving. At first, he's just this kind of like Matt said, a jaundiced human looking thing. And then he cuts on his face and sticks leaves in them. And then it literally turns into a leaf face creature. If you go to any garden center at a Home Depot, you're going to see this leaf face on
right,
some
it's a human face made of ferns almost.
Yeah. You've seen this. It's a pagan thing. And he transforms into this creature with the leaf face, which I thought was a terrible makeup. I thought it was actually really piss poor makeup job, horribly painted. Apologies if I know the person who did that. Anyway,
if I don't, fuck you.
Fuck you. He shows up and he's chasing after her. And then he's like, oh, God, I got a baby belly. And his stomach extends and rolls onto his back. And his fucking asshole stretches open and births another version of him.
Mm-hmm. And another one of the men in the movie. And he comes out fully grown.
Fully grown. And you're like, oh, wow. Wow.
Naked, covered in ichor, and just comes out. And then he gets up. And immediately his stomach distends and becomes a pregnant stomach, and he falls over and gives birth out of his booty. As what did you call it? An assgina?
Assgina, yeah.
And it's the movie does not shy away from the assgina, folks. So.
They get right up in there for it. The miracle of birth, guys. It's beautiful. and so you just get this like scene where it's like creature after creature spilling out, getting super pregnant, spilling over, something popping.
Everyone's
out of
got
bag.
The flopping hand, the cut in half flopping hand, and it's all different versions of the male that we've seen in this movie. It's the bartender, it's the police guy, it's the kid.
Yep, it's the kid. It's the vicar. You know, and it keeps stumbling towards her and then birthing out another version of it. It's really gnarly. And then he gets to the door and she picks up this axe. At this point, she's just like, I'm so fucking tired of this. She's like, over your bullshit. And she picks up this hatchet and she's staring at him. And he's like, bleh! And feet start coming out of his mouth. And these legs.
Wait, first, there's a back gina, right?
Yeah, I mentioned
first,
that.
Second to last, there's a back gina. It rips out the back. The guy comes out. Then, the last birth, she's about to axe him. And 2 feet pop up. Oh, and we didn't say this, but this whole chain of things being born one the creature, every man creature's right foot, right ankle is all broken and messed up, which mirrors her husband who killed himself,
yeah.
possibly killed himself. His thing was messed up. And the hand that was cut in half was his hand that was stuck on
the fence,
the pointed fence. So yeah, now we see the last birth. You see 2 feet pop out of the thing's mouth and a birth out the mouth. But who is the last birth?
It's her husband, her dead ex-husband. He walks in and he's like, hey, Harper. She's like, finally,
they
okay,
sit
hey.
Down on a couch together.
And he's just covered in blood and viscera and just
naked
birth, after birth. And he's just sitting there and she's like, what the fuck do you want? And he's like, I just want you to love me. And she's like, ugh. And like, just she's so over this bullshit. And then we cut to dawn. Daytime, and her friend who was like, I'm coming to help you, I'm coming to save you, she shows up and she sees her just covered in blood sitting on the porch, and she seems fine, and Harper's like, hey, she smiles, and that's the end of the movie.
Man,
I loved the birthing scene again. Whoa, what am I watching? This is crazy. I've never seen anything like this. This is one of the gnarliest, craziest things I've ever seen in my life. But then when he comes in and she's just over it, it deflated everything for me, because she was just like her response to it. If she was scared, I would have stayed scared with her.
Sure, sure.
But when she was just like, when she's just like, OK, what the fuck else are you going to throw at me? I've watched 5 dudes be birthed in the past 1 minute and and I have a hatchet. Whatever comes through this door, I'm going to put this hatchet in his face. And I was like, her bravery made me be like, well, whatever it is, it's going to be fine. And then when her ex-husband came in, I was like, full circle allegory. Like, oh my God, it completely killed it for me. And then when he's like, I just want you to love me, then you're like, all of this is just pathetic. And I get it. I mean, like, men... The ego of men is absolutely a pathetic thing, you know?
And I'm going to say his character from the beginning, pathetic is a good word. I agree with it. But his whole thing was he tells her, if you divorce me, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah.
And she's like, you can't say that to me. And he continues to just manipulate every word out of his mouth in that whole argument flashback series. He is manipulating her to try to push her in a corner so that she can't escape. So you know that this is not a good guy. This is a weak guy. This is a controlling guy. And she's pushing back. So when at the end, when he says, I just want you to love me, it rings true to his character. I get why you'd be deflated at the end. I wouldn't debate that. For me, I like my movies to be a little bit, my ending specifically, to be a little bit more certain. I don't mind if you don't tell me something and I have to discuss it or figure it out. But when I don't know what the fuck is going on, you usually lose me. This was so fucking crazy and it was done so cool that I didn't care that I didn't quite understand what Alex Garland is trying. He's a writer. I think someone else wrote it with him. But I don't. The fact that I didn't quite get what that allegory was supposed to be with all those guys being birthed, especially in the moment, I didn't mind it because it was such a powerful ending. What I said at the beginning of this part of the show, how I lean in, I didn't just strap my seatbelt on and watch this movie. I kept asking questions. Who is that naked guy? Why aren't they believing her? How come they all look the same? Why does that little boy have a mask? Blah, blah, blah. When you get to the end there, I love that it's open-ended in a way that you and I, me and Amanda, our listeners and us can discuss. What do you think? Like, Rooms, this is the kind of movie we would watch and then bullshit about after and be like, so what the fuck did you think happened? And I loved it. And I really thought it was, you know, very much about the toxic masculinity thing until I read that the actress who plays the lead role, Jessie Buckley, said something to the effect of, I like that I am not the, and I'm paraphrasing, but she said, I like that I am not like the regular final girl. I don't face the, she said, dragon. I don't face the dragon at the end and beat it. I don't even face the dragon at the end and lose. I face the dragon and realize I have to live with it. The dragon, and to me, I like the way this fits overall, more than the toxic masculinity. This movie is about grief. This movie is about your baggage. This movie is about your guilt. And I think all those men, although I do think we are very much making a statement about men, I think it's really interesting to think about that as that monster, that creature, that entity. Is her grief, is her feeling, it's her trauma. And it doesn't matter what you're going to do. That's going to keep coming at you. It might look like this. It might look like that. It might look like this, but it's always going to be the same. And it's always going to be with you. And her trauma is ultimately this guy, this relationship, this how it ended. She's got to deal with it. She can't deal with it with a hatchet. So when she says that to him, I think that is her standing up to her feelings. That's her stopping running, stopping fighting, stopping feeling sorry for herself and saying, okay, what is my issue here? That my husband fucking killed himself because of the way our relationship ended. How am I going to move forward from that? It's not by running. It's not by going to a house. It's not by locking the door. And I love that. And for me, and I think I've talked about feelings and stuff in the show before, I love that this movie ends with her friend walking over and sitting down next to her. Because I think that shows like, you gotta like, she's not going to fight this monster with an axe. She's going to fight this monster sitting on a stoop with her friend, talking about this, examining this. You know what
she
I mean?
She says it early in the movie. She says it early in the movie when they're like, I didn't change my name. And I kind of outed the fact that we're divorced. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry that. And she's like, well, I got to get used to it. That's going to happen to me probably for the rest of my life. And I like you said, this movie is dealing with four people is dealing with two things. And it's a grief story, but then has this men element added to it. And I think with both these Alex Garland movies, maybe you called it the wrong fucking thing. Civil War was not about a civil war. If you had called it journalist movie, war journalist or something like that, I may have been even more. Again, I didn't think Civil War was bad, but I think that was a misleading title. And this movie, Men, does focus quite a bit on sort of these men. But why? Why is that the other part of this story? Is it how men treat women who are grieving? Mm-hmm. You know, you have Joffrey, who is, like you said, he's the nice guy. And he's like, oh, no. Don't lift a finger. Let me go help you. He's full of chivalry. But she just kind of thinks he's cheesy. Mm-hmm. And then you have these, you know, the cop who just kind of dismisses her. And then you have the rapey priest. You know, but
the little boy just wants to play with her, literally keeps saying, let's play hide and seek.
Yeah, but he is like the true effigy of this entity, whatever it is. So I think some of it gets lost in its mythology. Like, is any of that entity important? Because like when you watch a movie like did you see Mother with Jennifer Lawrence?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's all allegory. None of that movie matters. It doesn't matter why it happens. It's allegory for a bigger picture. Mm-hmm. Is this movie doing allegory for toxic masculinity, or is the monster real? And it tries to say that the monster's real. Well, then why is Jeffrey suddenly a bad guy? There's some inconsistencies to me in what that lore is. And because at the end, they're like, it doesn't matter what the lore is. Then you're like, well, was it allegory? Does it, you know, when you have a movie that has an entity or a monster or a creature, a lot of times we like to explain where it came from. It came from space. It was awoken when we opened its grave. Right. You know, it's a deity from a long time ago. And this movie's like, nah, none of that matters. You know, it's about grief. Okay. Well, if it's about grief, what are these male characters all about? Mm-hmm. Well, they're monsters. Oh, okay. Tell me about that monster. No, it's an allegory. Huh. That's kind of where I get lost in what the big picture was. Again, super cool scenes, did cool shit. I like that, but I either want you to show me what the monster is or stick to the allegory harder for the whole thing.
Do you think by not explaining the toxic masculinity and men aspect, do you think by not explaining, by not telling you specific information about that, they're telling you that it doesn't matter?
No,
twice you just said, oh, it doesn't matter. Do you think the movie is telling us that it doesn't matter or that it's less important?
No, I think it's telling me that the toxic masculinity thing is the important part. The monster is not the important part. But to me, the monster, because you're actually trying to show me that it's a monster and not an allegory.
Yeah.
Because like you either needed to explain a little bit more of what the monster is or not get into that at all. You know, just let the allegory ride, because if it's all about allegory and we can talk about it and stuff, to me, there's a tangible physical creature element that you now have not explained, which, again, isn't necessarily a problem. I don't need to know where the villains came from, but I just want to know, was it real or was it all just allegory? And the best monsters are good allegories. Babadook is an allegory for a mother's feelings about her child, the pain that she has to live with this child. And this again steeped in allegory, but then what is the creature? The Babadook was like, it's a Babadook, bitches. Here's the lore of the Babadook. We didn't get any lore from this movie other than, you know, a picture of a stone temple basin in a church. And I think that that left me a little bit of well, what am I supposed to think about that? And they're like, exactly. And I'm like, all right, well, okay.
I guess I can understand that, because I feel like in this movie I like it, but I might watch a movie tonight that does essentially the same thing, but I might not like it. Like I said, I usually like it a little bit more cut and dry. I usually like you don't have to spoon feed me. It doesn't have to be an explanation. But when it's so esoteric that I'm like, was there really a monster, or was that an allegory that she was seeing? Yeah. And you could go back and watch the movie and kind of make a judgment call on that yourself. But like, I like to be told, wait, just tell me if the monster was real or was that in her mind? Like, yes. Just tell me that. But
just tell
in
me
this
that.
Case,
yeah.
I like how vague it was, because I think it meshes with what I'm taking away from the movie, I guess. And I guess maybe if you told me, Matt, this is what I think all of that was, maybe if I disagreed with your version, it would matter to me more whether the monster was real or not. But for me, the way that I'm interpreting it, the way that I take it about or take out of it, I'm okay with everything that it was. And again, I was leaning in the whole time. I wanted to know more about everything. They said, when they eventually say what happened to the husband, they say that he climbed up to the roof. They went to the roof, and she says he was either climbing down the balcony. They said he broke into the apartment above her, is what she said.
I was trying
there
to
was no one
down,
home,
yeah.
And he tried to climb down, and she said she's not sure if he fell or if he decided fuck it and just let go. And I love the ambiguity there, even, because it's like, if he fell, does that make her any more or less culpable than if he said, fuck this and let go? Or if he decided to make his threat? Because when you see him fall, it's one of the first things you see in the movie. He looks scared.
Whoopsie. Yeah, he looks like a whoops.
It does not look like he jumped. But then again, I don't know, like, what does your face do when you decide to jump to your death? Like, do you look serene because you've made a decision?
I've jumped off of a boat on purpose, like a high boat. Like, you're up and they're like, hey, if you want to climb up to the top of the boat and jump off. And that jump was just long enough for me to go, oh, this is way higher than I expected.
While you're on the way down, you mean?
Yeah. On the way down, you're like, yeah. Oh, shit.
Right.
Like, suddenly you're like, I did not take a deep enough breath for this, for the length of this drop. And so, yeah, maybe in his moment of like, but yeah, this will show her. Oh, I regret everything I've done. I think it's I love that it's making you ask questions.
Mm-hmm.
I love that the movie did that. I just think that if you're going to leave questions on the table, make sure you know which ones are left. And I think the what is this creature is not one that should have been left on the table. I think they should have either not shown it as a creature. Like, if we had not seen those scenes where he's like putting the leaves in his face, if you had kept some of the things out that made it a very true physical thing, and you're just like, because like in Carnival of Souls, again, you never find out who that creepy face thing is. He just keeps appearing. If this guy had just kept appearing, and it just started to spread, that would have been, to me, more of a, like, let's just leave it allegory thing. But the fact that they show times where it's a physical creature to get us to these cool, like, birthing scenes, it kind of makes me go, well, that's something you left on the table. And that takes away from, to me, some of the allegory questions that are more interesting to discuss. Very well done, though, and very well acted. Holy shit. The guy who plays Rory Kinnear, who plays all the characters, all the male characters, crushed it.
Yeah, part of the reason I wasn't sure if it was the same guy is because the characters are very different. And they're not very layered. It's not like giant, huge things. You only see them for a speck each time. But it's enough to trick you into thinking it's different guys. It's check it out. I want to hear, this is like definitely one of those topics we want to hear from listeners. We want to hear from you guys. Let us know what you thought about either movie, Civil War or Men. And I'll tell you, the actress who is the lead in Men, Jesse Buckley, she was in a movie with what's his name?
Jesse
the
guy. Plemons.
Yeah. She was in a movie called I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which I think was on Netflix recently. I think it still is. It is such a cool, creepy movie like this one, in my opinion, where shit starts happening. You're like, ooh, what is this? Who's this family? Why is this person acting like this? And then as it starts to unravel, you're like, oh, fuck. I loved it. I loved her in it. I love Jesse Plemons in it. I loved Colette What's-Her-Face, who I normally cannot stand. I loved her in this.
Oh, I'm Thinking of Ending Things?
Yeah. Yeah, let me.
She whatever. Was in the fourth season of Fargo, the TV series.
Yeah.
Which I really like. And she was awesome in that. She had a very quirky character where she's like
Toni
this,
Collette. That's her name, Toni Collette.
Jesse Buckley played this character in the fourth season of Fargo. And she's like this nurse, this like angel of death nurse who's like secretly killing men. Mm. And love her character. She's so quirky and funny. And I liked it. I thought she was great.
Do you think
great.
It's the same character from Men and she's just taking revenge on the gender?
No, because she's super Southern and she's like from Kentucky in that. And she's Irish the rest of the time.
I like she's my Jake Gyllenhaal right now where I'm like, if I'm on Netflix or Hulu or whatever and I see her in a movie, I'm going to hit play just because I like everything she's doing. So now, nice. But guys, tell us what you think about these two movies. There's a lot there to unravel. We would love to see what you guys think about them.
If you just turned off the sound and put on an Aphex Twin song, Men fits perfectly into their music video canon. There's a late 90s reference for you.
I was going to say, Aphex Twin just popped their head up. Like, did someone just call us? What was that?
What was that? That's a weird drop. Music video? What is that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, let us know. Social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Launchpad Pod, and our website, launchpadpod.com, and on YouTube. Yeah, this was a long-ass episode, and got pretty deep, a little emotional there for a moment. But, hey, that's us. We get to week.
And again, to wrap, to bookend it, that's what fucking storytelling is, right? Like, I was explaining to Kent the other day about how, like, sometimes they make movies to feel sad about. Like, there are some movies that it's made to try to make you cry, and that's part of the human experience, and I love that. I think that's so amazing. I think that there's a movie that I love that I don't know if I could ever watch it again because of how tense it made me. That's good storytelling, man. That's a good movie, you know? I just think that concept, just the idea of that is so fucking cool.
Yeah, no, 100%, man. Well, it's always good to talk about this stuff with you, man. I love doing this podcast. I love that we can get into tell a bunch of dick jokes and ass gina jokes, yeah. And then but then also
that's true. Rumi was crying and talking about an ass gina in the same episode.
I defy
you to show me another podcast that does
that. It's that deep. Yeah, I really felt the emotions talking about war. And guys, be good to each other. Don't dehumanize anybody to the point that you are okay with murder. Like, that's fucked up. So let's all give each other a hug and come find some common ground. And I think movies are always a great place to find that common ground. Like, oh, fuck yeah, you like Star Wars too? Me too. Awesome. You know, there's always good places in media and music and food and movies that we can agree on and then hopefully come to solutions to solve our problems. Because at the end of the day, we all want the same thing, a little bit of entertainment, some food on the table and a good place to live. So let's all strive for that. One thing left to do, Rumi. Let's blast this thing off. We're going to ride out on the we're the Rocketeers and we are out.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.